This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Good Girl, Bad Girl, written by Michael Robotham and read by Joe Jameson. For want of a toy, a child was lost. Tom Waits, Misery is the River of the World. Chapter 1. Which one is she? I ask, leaning closer to the observation window.
Blonde, baggy sweater, sitting on her own.
And you're not going to tell me why I'm here?
I don't want to influence your decision.
What am I deciding?
Just watch her.
I look again at the group of teenagers, girls and boys. Most are wearing jeans and long tops with the sleeves pulled down to hide whatever self-inflicted damage has been done. Some are cutters, some are burners or scratchers, or bulimics or anorexics, or obsessive compulsives, or pyromaniacs, or sociopaths, or narcissists, or suffering from ADHD. Some abuse food or drugs, others swallow foreign objects, or run into walls on purpose, or take outrageous risks. Evie Cormack has her knees drawn up, almost as though she doesn't trust the floor. Sullen-mouthed and pretty, she could be 18, or she could be 14. Not quite a woman or a girl about to bid goodbye to childhood, yet there is something ageless and changeless about her, as if she has seen the worst and survived it. With brown eyes framed by thickened eyelashes and bleached hair cut in a ragged bob, she's holding the sleeves of her sweater in her bunched fists, stretching the neckline, revealing a pattern of red blotches below her jawline that could be love bites or finger marks. Adam Guthrie is standing alongside me, regarding Evie like she is the latest arrival at Twycross Zoo.
Why is she here? I ask.
Her current index office is for aggravated assault. She broke someone's jaw with a half brick.
Her current offence?
She's had a few.
How many?
Too few to mention.
He's attempting to be funny, or deliberately obtuse. We're at Langford Hall, a secure children's home in Nottingham, where Guthrie is a resident social worker. He's dressed in baggy jeans, combat boots, and a rugby jumper, trying too hard to look like one of them. Someone who can relate to teenage delinquency and strife, rather than an underpaid, low-level public servant with a wife, a mortgage, and two kids. He and I were at university together and lived in the same college. I wouldn't say we were friends, more like passing acquaintances, although I went to his wedding a few years ago and slept with one of the bridesmaids. I didn't know she was Guthrie's youngest sister. Would it have made a difference? I'm not sure. He hasn't held it against me.
You ready?
I nod. We enter the room and take two chairs, joining the circle of teenagers, who watch us with a mixture of suspicion and boredom.
We have a visitor today, says Guthrie. This is Cyrus Haven.
Who is he?
Asks one of the girls. I'm a psychologist, I reply.
Another one,
says the same girl, screwing up her face.
Cyrus is here to observe.
Us or you?
Both.
I look for Evie's reaction. She's watching me blankly. Guthrie crosses his legs, revealing a hairless, pale ankle where his trouser cuff has ridden up his shin. He's a jolly, fat sort of bloke who rubs his hands together at the start of something, presupposing the fun that awaits.
Let's begin with some introductions, shall we? I want you to each tell Cyrus your name, where you're from, and why you're here. Who wants to go first?
Nobody answers.
How about you, Alana?
She shakes her head. I'm sitting directly opposite Evie. She knows I'm looking at her.
Holly?
Asks Guthrie.
Nah.
Evie?
She doesn't respond.
It's nice to see you're wearing more clothes today, says Guthrie. You too, Holly.
Evie snorts.
That was a legitimate protest,
argues Holly, growing more animated.
We were protesting against the outdated assumptions of class and gender inherent in this white male-dominated gulag.
Thank you, comrade, says Guthrie sarcastically. Will you get us started, Nathan?
Don't call me Nathan,
says a beanpole of a boy with pimples on his forehead.
Well, what should I call you?
Nut. You mean like a bug?
Asks Evie. He spells it out.
N-A-T.
Guthrie takes a small knitted teddy bear from his pocket and tosses it to Nat.
You're up first. Remember, whoever has the bear has the right to speak. Nobody else can interrupt.
Nat bounces the teddy bear on his thigh.
I'm from Sheffield, and I'm here because I took a dump in my neighbour's VW when he left it unlocked.
Titters all round. Evie doesn't join in.
Why did you do that?
Asks Guthrie. Nat shrugs nonchalantly.
It were a laugh.
And the driver's seat?
Asks Holly.
Yeah, of course. Where else? The dickhead complained to the police, so me and my mates gave him a kicking.
Do you feel bad about that?
Asks Guthrie.
Not really.
He had to have metal plates put in his head.
Yeah, but he had insurance and he got compensation. My ma had to pay a fine, way I see it, the dickhead made money.
Guthrie starts to argue but changes his mind, perhaps recognising the futility. The teddy bear is passed on to Reba from Nottingham, who is painfully thin and who sewed her lips together because her father tried to make her eat.
What did he make you eat?
Asks another of the girls, who is so fat that her thighs are forcing her knees apart.
Food.
What sort of food?
Birthday cake.
You're an idiot.
Guthrie interrupts.
Please don't make critical comments, Cordelia. You can only speak if you have the bear.
Give it to me then,
she says, snatching the bear from Reba's lap.
Hey, I wasn't finished.
The girls wrestle for a moment until Guthrie intervenes, but Reba has forgotten what she wanted to say. The bear is in a new lap.
My name is Cordelia, and I'm from Leeds, and when someone pisses me off, I fight them, you know. I make them pay.
You get angry? Asks Guthrie.
Yeah.
What sort of things make you angry?
When people call me fat.
You are fat, says Evie.
Shut the fuck up!
Yells Cordelia, jumping to her feet. She's twice Evie's size.
Say that again and I'll fucking batter you.
Guthrie has put himself between them.
Apologise, Evie.
Evie smiles sweetly.
I'm sorry for calling you fat, Cordelia. I think you've lost weight. You look positively svelte.
What's that mean?
She asks.
Skinny.
Fuck off!
Okay, let's all settle down, says Guthrie. Cordelia, why are you here?
I grew up too soon,
she replies.
I lost my virginity at like 11. I slept with guys and slept with girls and smoked a lot of pot. I tried heroin at 12 and ice when I was 13.
Evie rolls her eyes. Cordelia glares at her.
My mum called the police on me, so I tried to poison her with floor cleaner.
To punish her? Asks Guthrie.
Maybe,
says Cordelia.
It was like an experiment, you know. I wanted to, like, see what would happen.
Did it work?
Asks Nat.
Nah,
replies Cordelia.
She said the soup tasted funny and didn't finish the bowl. Made her vomit, that's all.
You should have used wolfsbane,
says Nat.
What's that?
It's a plant. I heard about this gardener who died when he touched the leaves.
My mum doesn't like gardening,
says Cordelia, missing the point. Guthrie passes the teddy bear to Evie.
Your turn.
Nope.
Why not?
The details of my life are inconsequential.
That's not true.
Evie sighs and leans forward, resting her forearms on her knees, squeezing the bear with both hands. Her accent changes.
My father was a relentlessly self-improving boulangerie owner from Belgium with low-grade narcolepsy and a penchant for buggery. My mother was a 15-year-old French prostitute named Chloe with webbed feet.
I laugh. Everybody looks at me. It's from Austin Powers, I explain. More blank stares. The movie? Mike Myers? Dr. Evil? Still nothing. Evie puts on a gruff Scottish accent.
First things first, where's your shitter? I've got a turtle head poking out.
Fat bastard, I say. Evie smiles. Guthrie is annoyed with me, as though I'm fermenting unrest. He calls on another teenager, who has a blue streak in her hair and piercings in her ears, eyebrows and nose.
Yeah, what brings you here, Serena?
Well, it's a long story.
Groans all round. Serena recounts an episode from her life when she went to America as an exchange student at 16 and lived with a family in Ohio, whose son was in prison for murder. Every fortnight they insisted Serena visit him, making her wear her sexiest clothes. Short dresses, low-cut tops.
He was on the other side of the glass, and his father kept telling me to lean closer and show him my tits.
Evie sneezes into the crook of her arm in a short, sharp exhalation that sounds a lot like...
Bullshit!
Serena glares at her, but goes on with her story.
One night when I was sleeping, the father came into my room and raped me. I was too frightened to tell my parents or call the police. I was alone in a foreign country, thousands of miles from home.
She looks around the group, hoping for sympathy. Evie sneezes again, making the same sound. Serena tries to ignore her.
Back home, I started having problems, drinking and cutting myself. My parents sent me to see a therapist who seemed really nice at the beginning until he tried to rape me.
For fuck's sake,
says Evie, sighing in disgust.
We're not here to pass judgment, Guthrie warns her.
But she's making shit up. What's the point of sharing if people are going to tell lies?
Fuck you,
shouts Serena, flipping Evie the finger.
Bite me, says Evie.
Serena leaps to her feet.
You're a freak. Everybody knows it.
Please, sit down, says Guthrie, trying to keep the girls apart.
She called me a fucking liar.
No, I didn't, says Evie. I called you a psycho fucking liar.
Serena ducks under Guthrie's arm and launches herself across the space, knocking Evie off her chair. The two of them are wrestling on the floor, but Evie seems to be laughing as she wards off the blows. An alarm has been raised, and a security team bursts into the group therapy room, dragging Serena away. The rest of the teenagers are ordered back to their bedrooms, all except for Evie. Dusting herself off, she touches the corner of her lip, rubbing a smudge of blood between her thumb and forefinger. I give her a tissue. Are you all right?
I'm fine. She punches like a girl.
What happened to your neck?
Someone tried to strangle me.
Why?
I have that sort of face.
I pull up a chair and motion for Evie to sit down. She complies, crossing her legs, revealing an electronic tag on her ankle. Why are you wearing that?
They think I'm trying to escape.
Are you? Evie raises her forefinger to her lips and makes a shushing sound.
First chance I get.
Chapter 2. Guthrie meets me in a pub called The Man of Iron, named after the nearby Stanton Ironworks, which closed down years ago. He's perched on a stool with an empty pint glass resting between his elbows, watching a fresh beer being pulled.
Your regular boozer? I ask, sitting next to him. My escape, he replies.
His fingers are pudgy and pale, decorated with a tri-band wedding ring. The barman asks if I want something. I shake my head, and Guthrie looks disappointed to be drinking alone. Over his shoulder I see a lounge area with a pool table and fruit machines that ping and blink like a fairground ride.
You're looking good, I say, lying. How's married life? Terrific, great, making me fat.
He pats his stomach.
You should try it.
Getting fat?
Marriage.
How are the kids?
Growing like weeds. We have two now, a boy and a girl, 8 and 5.
I can't remember his wife's name, but recall her being Eastern European, with a thick accent and a wedding dress that looked like a craft project that had gone horribly wrong. Guthrie had met her when he was teaching part-time at an English language school in London.
What did you think of Evie?
He asks.
She's a real charmer.
She's one of them.
One of who?
The lie detectors.
I suppress a laugh. He looks aggrieved.
You saw her. She knew when they were lying. She's a truth wizard, just like you wrote about.
You read my thesis?
Every word?
I make a face. That was 8 years ago.
It was published.
And I concluded that truth wizards didn't exist.
No, you said they represented a tiny percentage of the population, maybe 1 in 500, and the best of them were accurate 80% of the time. You also wrote that someone could develop even greater skills, a person who wasn't disrupted by emotions or lack of familiarity with the subject, someone who functioned at a higher level.
Christ, he did read it. I want to stop the conversation and tell Guthrie he's wrong. I spent 2 years researching truth wizards, reading the literature, exploring the research, and testing more than 3,000 volunteers. Evie Cormack is too young to be a truth wizard. Usually they're middle-aged or older, able to draw upon their experiences in certain professions, such as detectives, judges, lawyers, psychologists, and secret service agents. Teenagers are too busy looking in the mirror, or studying their phones to be reading the subtle, almost imperceptible changes in people's facial expressions, or the nuances of their body language or their tones of voice. Guthrie is waiting for me to respond.
I think you're mistaken, I say.
But you saw her do it!
She's a very clever, manipulative teenager. The social worker sighs and peers into his half-empty glass.
She's driven me to this.
What?
Drinking. According to my doctor, I have the body of a 60-year-old. I have high blood pressure, fatty tissue around my heart, and borderline cirrhosis.
How is that Evie's fault?
Every time I talk to her, I want to curl up in a ball and sob. I took 2 months off earlier in the year, stress leave, but it didn't help. Now my wife is threatening to leave me unless I agree to see a marriage counsellor. I haven't told a soul that information, but somehow Evie knew.
How?
How'd you think?
Guthrie doesn't wait for me to respond.
Believe me, Cyrus, she can tell when people are lying.
Even if that were true, I don't see why I'm here.
You could help her.
How?
Evie has made an application to the court to be released, but she's not ready to leave Langford Hall. She's dyslexic, antisocial, aggressive. She has no friends. Nobody ever visits her. She's a danger to herself and others.
If she's 18, she has the right to move on.
Guthrie hesitates and tugs at his collar, pulling it away from his neck.
Nobody knows her true age.
What do you mean?
There's no record of her birth.
I blink at him. There must be something. A hospital file, a midwife's report, school enrolments.
There are no records.
That's impossible. Guthrie takes a moment to finish his beer and signal the barman for another. He drops his voice to a whisper.
What I'm about to tell you is highly confidential. I'm talking classified. You can't breathe a word of this to anyone.
I want to laugh. Guthrie is the least likely spy in history.
I'm serious, Cyrus.
Okay. His beer arrives. He centres it on a cardboard coaster and waits for the barman to wander out of earshot. A shaft of sunlight is slanting through a window. Full of floating specks, it gives the pub the ambience of a church and that we're in a confessional.
Evie is the girl in the box.
Who?
Angel Face.
Immediately, I understand the reference.
but want to argue. That can't be right.
It's her.
But that was 6 years ago. I remember the story. A girl found living in a secret room in a house in North London. Thought to be 11 or 12, she weighed less than a child of half that age. A mop-headed, wild-eyed, feral-looking creature, more animal than human. She could have been raised by wolves. Her hiding spot was only feet away from where the police had discovered the decomposing body of a man who had been tortured to death, sitting upright in a chair. The girl had lived with the corpse for months, sneaking out to steal food and sharing it with the two dogs that were kennelled in the garden. Those first images were flashed around the world. They showed an off-duty special constable carrying a small child through the doors of a hospital. The girl wouldn't let anyone else touch her, and her only words were to ask for food and whether the dogs were all right. The nurses dubbed her Angel Face because they had to call her something. The details of her captivity dominated the news for weeks. Everybody had a question. Who was she? Where had she come from? How had she survived? Guthrie has been waiting for me to catch up.
She was never identified, he explains. The police tried everything. Missing persons, files, DNA, bone x-rays, stable isotopes. Her photograph went around the world, but nothing came back.
How could a child appear out of nowhere, with no record of her birth or her passage through life? Guthrie continues.
She became a ward of the court and was given a new name, Evie Cormack. The Home Secretary added a Section 39 order, which forbids anybody from revealing her identity or location, or taking any pictures or footage of her.
Who knows? I ask.
At Langford Hall, only me.
Why is she here?
There's no one else.
I don't understand.
She was placed in a dozen different foster homes, but each time she either ran away or they sent her back. She's also had 4 caseworkers, 3 psychologists, and God knows how many social workers. I'm the last one standing.
What's her mental health status?
She passed every psych test from Balthazar to Winslow.
I still don't understand why I'm here. Guthrie sucks an inch off his pint and looks along the bar.
Like I said, Evie is a ward of the court, meaning the High Court makes all the important decisions about her welfare, while the local authority controls her day-to-day care. 2 months ago, she petitioned to be classed as an adult.
If she's deemed to be 18, she has every right. Guthrie looks at me plaintively.
She's a danger to herself and others. If she succeeds...
He shudders, unable to finish.
Imagine having her ability.
You make it sound like a superpower.
It is,
he says, earnestly. I think you're exaggerating.
She clocked you straight away.
Being perceptive doesn't make someone a truth wizard. He lifts his eyebrows, as though he expected more of me. I think you're trying to fob her off, I say.
Gladly, he says. But that's not the reason. I honestly thought you could help her. Everybody else has failed.
Has she ever talked about what happened to her? In the house, I mean.
No. According to Evie, she has no past, no family, and no memories.
She's blocked them out.
Maybe. At the same time, she lies, she obfuscates, she casts shade and misdirects. She's a nightmare.
I don't think she's a truth wizard, I say.
Okay.
What files can you show me?
I'll get them to you. Some of the early details have been redacted to protect her new identity.
You said Evie broke someone's jaw. Who was it? I ask.
A male member of staff found £2,000 in her room. He figured Evie must have stolen the money and took it from her, saying he was going to hand it over to the police.
What happened?
Evie knew he was lying.
Where did she get the money? I ask.
She said she won it playing poker.
Is that possible?
I wouldn't bet against her.
Chapter 3 Angel Face.
I enjoy the mathematics of smoking. Every cigarette takes 14 minutes off my life, according to a poster I read in a doctor's surgery. When I add the 6 minutes it takes to smoke each one, it makes a total of 20 minutes, an hour for every three. I like those numbers. I'm only allowed 4 a day, which I have to smoke outside in the courtyard while a member of staff watches over me, ready to confiscate the lighter afterwards, in case I try to burn the place down. Sucking hard on the filter, I hold the smoke inside my chest, picturing the toxic chemicals and black tar clogging my lungs, causing cancer or emphysema, or rotting my teeth. A slow death, I know, but that's life, isn't it? A long, drawn-out suicide. I'm sitting on a bench where I can feel the coldness of the concrete through my torn, indigo-coloured Levi's, which I stole from Primark. I slip a forefinger through one of the frayed holes and widen the tear as far as the seam. I press my thumb into the skin on my thigh, watching how the blood rushes back into the pale blotch. Although barefoot, I don't feel the cold. I've been in colder places. I've had fewer clothes. Pulling my foot into my lap, I begin picking off my toenail polish, not liking the colour anymore. It's too girly. Dumb. I should never wear pastel colours, pinks and mauves. I once experimented with black, but it made my toenails look diseased. I think about the group session. Guthrie brought a guest, a shrink with a strange name. Cyrus. He was handsome for an old guy, at least 30, with thick dark hair and green eyes that looked sad, as though he might be homesick or missing someone. He didn't say much. Instead, he watched and listened. Most men talk too much and rarely listen. They talk about themselves, or give orders, or make decisions. They have cruel or hungry eyes, but rarely sad eyes. Davina knocks on the window and shakes her dreadlocks.
Who are you talking to, Evie?
Nobody.
Come inside now.
I'm not finished. Davina is one of the house mothers, a title that makes Langford Hall sound like a boarding school rather than a secure children's home, by which they mean prison. There are locks on my doors, and CCTV watching the corridors, and if I kicked off right now, a 3-person control and restraint team would wrestle me to the ground and truss me up like a Christmas turkey. Davina knocks on the glass again, making an eating motion. Lunch is ready. I'm not hungry.
You have to eat.
I'm not feeling well.
Do you want another red card?
Red cards are given for misbehaviour and swearing at staff. I can't afford another one, or I'll miss our Sunday excursion. This week we're going to see a movie at Cineworld. My life always seems better when I'm sitting in the dark with a warm tub of popcorn between my thighs, watching someone else's shitty life flash before my eyes. Nobody ever gets a green card. You'd have to cure cancer or bring peace to the world, or let Mrs. Porter look at you naked in the shower. Girls only, of course. She doesn't look at boys the same way. Crushing the cigarette against the brickwork, I watch the sparks flare and fade before tossing the butt into the muddy garden. Davina raps on the window. I roll my eyes. She jabs her finger. I retrieve the butt and hold it up, mouthing the word satisfied before popping it into my mouth, chewing and swallowing. I open wide. All gone. Davina looks disgusted and shakes her head. Back in my room, I brush my teeth and reapply my mascara and foundation, hiding my freckles. I won't earn another strike unless I'm 15 minutes late for a meal. When I arrive in the dining room, most of the other kids are finishing because boredom makes them hungry. The room smells of baked cheese and overcooked Brussels sprouts. I take a tray and move past the hot food, collecting 2 pots of yogurt, a banana, and a box of muesli.
There for breakfast, says a server.
I didn't have breakfast.
Whose fault is that?
She takes back the muesli. I look for a place to sit down. Whenever I spy an empty seat, someone moves quickly to deny me the place. They're all in on the game. Eventually, one of the girls doesn't react swiftly enough, and I get to a chair first. Freak, she mutters. Thank you. Dyke. You're too kind. Retard. You're welcome. I peel the top from a tub of yogurt and spoon it into my mouth, turning the spoon upside down and pushing my tongue into the hollow. I'm aware of people moving behind me, so I keep one arm braced across my tray, preventing anyone from flipping it over. I can't stop them spitting or putting bogies in my food, but it doesn't happen so much these days, because most of them are frightened of me. The same is true of the staff, especially Mrs. Porter, who calls me that devil child. I don't mind the name-calling, because I'm harder on myself than any member of staff. Nobody can hate like I can. I hate my body. I hate my thoughts. I am ugly, stupid, and dirty, damaged goods. Nobody will ever want me. The bully barks. The bully laughs. The bully wins.
Chapter 4. Sun sinking. Autumn cold. I run along Parkside, zigzagging through the gate into Woolerton Park, where a sign warns me that I'm entering a deer carving area and that no unleashed dogs are allowed. The sky is streaked from edge to edge with pale trails of jets that have passed in the stratosphere. Jogging beneath a tunnel of bare trees, the asphalt path moves like a conveyor belt beneath my feet. Things come and go, park benches, garden beds, walkers and cyclists. I run twice around the lake before climbing a rise towards the Elizabethan country house that gives the park its name. Woolerton Hall once took my breath away, but I've grown tired of its grandeur because it seems to be showing off. Deer raise their heads, pausing from their grazing as I ghost past them along an avenue of lime trees towards the eastern entrance to the park. My right hip twinges, but I like the pain because it helps me focus. Wearing jogging shorts, a quilted red windbreaker, woolen hat and lightweight runners, I move in an easy rhythm, turning back at Middleton Boulevard and retracing my route through the park. Running is many things to me. Calmness, solitude, punishment, survival. In a world beset by problems that I cannot control, I can tell my body what to do and it will obey for as long as it can. When I run, my thoughts become clearer. When I run, I imagine that I'm keeping pace with a planet that turns too quickly for me. I think about Evie Cormack. More of the details have come back to me. She was discovered behind a false wall at the back of a walk-in wardrobe in an upstairs bedroom. The house, in North London, had been rented by a low-level crim called Terry Boland. It was his body police had found in the same bedroom 6 weeks earlier. He was strapped to a chair with belts around his neck and forehead. The killer, or killers, had used an eyedropper to put acid into Boland's ears, slowly burning through his eardrums, destroying his cochlear and auditory nerves. Once he was deaf, they heated a metal poker with a blowtorch and used it to burn through his eyelids and his corneas, until his pupils boiled in their sockets. I remember this because the tabloids seemed to revel in every prurient detail. The murder was still under investigation when Angel Face emerged from her hiding place. Nurses cleaned off the muck and washed her hair, discovering a pale, pixie-faced thing with freckles and dirty brown eyes, a child too small to hold her own history. In the days that followed, she dominated the news cycle. The entire nation seemed to adopt her, discussing her fate over dinner tables, in hotel bars, across backyard fences and in supermarket queues. There were public appeals, newspaper awards and offers to adopt her. I know what it's like to be at the centre of a media storm. I was once the survivor, the lost little boy whose parents and sisters were murdered. I have been there, done that, seen the movie and stayed for the closing credits. Is that another reason Guthrie turned to me? Speeding up over the last mile, I check my watch as I reach the front gate, holding my wrist steady because I'm breathing so hard. I'm 40 seconds outside my best time. I'm happy with that. Lifting the latch on the gate, I walk up the front path to a tall, narrow house, my ancestral home. It once belonged to my grandparents, who retired some years ago to the south coast, preferring a modest bungalow in Weymouth to a 6-bedroom, Grade 2 listed house that looks like it should be haunted, or at least have a mad woman in the attic. It was crumbling then, it's falling down now, a masterpiece of urban decay. The ground floor has two large bay windows, and a handsome carved doorway with fluted half columns and lead-like glass panels that throw red and green patterns onto the hallway rug when the sun is angled in the right direction. To one side, a garage is almost completely overwhelmed by ivy, and to the rear, beyond a stone wall, an uncut meadow, guarded by ancient trees, makes up a quiet corner of Woolerton Park. As a child, I knew every cubbyhole, nook, and odd corner of this house. I explored them with my brother and sisters. We played hide-and-seek or other games that involved make-believe guns or swords or dungeons or dragons. We practiced jumping from one piece of furniture to the next, never touching the ground, which was molten lava or covered in spiders. Now the house is mine, my inheritance, my folly, my last link to the past. Periodically, property developers or estate agents knock on the door or push their business cards through the mail flap, trying to convince me to sell. I once made the mistake of letting one inside. He began talking about morning rooms and secondary kitchens and conservatories, offering quotes and discounted terms. "You're sitting on a gold mine," he said, "but we have to act quickly while the market is hot." "Before this place falls down," he should have said. I reach under a pot for the spare key. As I straighten, I notice an unmarked police car is parked opposite the house. I know it's a police car because two-way radio antennas are sticking from the roof, and a square-headed figure is behind the wheel. Unlocking the door, I walk to the kitchen, a big, high-ceilinged room with a scrubbed wooden table and mismatched wooden chairs. I get a glass of water from a spitting tap. The doorbell rings. Water spills down my chin. I want to ignore both things, but that's not going to happen. The shadow behind the stained glass is a detective in a misshapen suit, or maybe it's his body, medium height with short arms and spiked hair.
"I'm sorry to bother you. I tried to call ahead, but nobody had your phone number."
"I don't have one."
"What sort of person doesn't have a phone?"
"One with a pager." He sneaks a glance at me as though I'm mentally challenged. I turn and walk down the hallway. He follows, introducing himself.
"Yeah, I'm Detective Sergeant Alan Edgar. Lenny sent me to collect you."
"You call her Lenny?" He looks at me sheepishly.
"Chief Inspector Pavel."
I drink another glass of water. The silence plays on his nerves.
"We found the body of a teenage girl who went missing last night."
"Where?"
"In Clifton. Beside a footpath."
I rinse the glass and put it in the drainer.
"I need a shower."
"I'll be in the car,"
he says, glancing at the ceiling, as though the house might collapse at any moment. In the upstairs bathroom, I strip down and turn on the tap. The pipes clank and shudder as I wait for the water to arrive, spitting and hawking from the showerhead. Some days it remains cold as though testing me, or scalding hot as though punishing me. But whenever I call a plumber, he recommends ripping out the entire heating system and installing a new one, something I can't afford. Hot water arrives. I'm clean for another day. Dressed in old jeans, a flannelette shirt, and an olive-green army coat, I fill the pockets with a chapstick, keys, chewing gum, and my money clip. I have no pets to worry about, no plants to water, no other appointments to keep. D.S. Edgar opens the car door for me. I wonder if his mates call him Poe. There are worse nicknames. I've had some of them. At school I was called Virus, because of the rhyme.
"You're a psychologist?"
Edgar says, not a question.
"You treated a mate of mine in the SWAT team. You said he had PTSD and recommended he be medically retired. Pissed him right off."
"I can't talk about my clinical cases."
"Right, sure. You were probably right."
Probably means he thinks I got it wrong. I often get this reaction from police officers when they discover the work I do.
I'm the specialist they see after they've been attacked, or shot at, or have discharged a firearm, or witnessed a tragedy. I judge their mental state. I look for signs of trauma. I prevent suicides. The thin blue line can be a mentally fragile one. Edgar has grown uncomfortable with the silence.
How do you know the Gov?
He asks. We go way back.
Did you meet her on the job?
When I was a child. He doesn't react, but I recognise what he's doing. He's digging for details. He knows what happened to my family. I'm the boy who came home from football practice and found my father dead in the sitting room, and my mother on the kitchen floor, and my twin sisters hacked to death in the bedroom they shared upstairs. Did I really discover my older brother sitting on the sofa, watching TV, resting his feet on my father's body? I don't give him the opportunity. What do you know about the victim?
Jodie Sheehan, aged 15. She was last seen at a fireworks display at the Clifton playing fields. Her parents reported her missing this morning. Her body was found just after midday in a wooded area next to Silverdale Walk.
Who found her?
A woman walking a dog.
Why is it always someone walking a dog? We partially circle two roundabouts and enter a small triangle of streets squeezed between Clifton Lane and Fareham Brook. The cottages and semi-detached bungalows are post-war, with low-pitched roofs, flat-fronted facades and postage-stamp-sized front gardens. I know areas like this one, full of hard-working, respectable people who have pushed back against low pay, insecure employment and government austerity by working multiple jobs, driving second-hand cars and setting achievable goals rather than aspirational ones. Turning a corner, I see a crowd spilling onto the road. People jostle and press forward, hoping for a glimpse of the fallen girl or to see a real-life tragedy unfold that isn't on their TV screens. Two police cars are parked across the entrance to the community centre. Forensic technicians clad in light blue overalls are unloading silver cases from the sliding doors of a van. A handful of uniformed officers are keeping the crowd behind bollards and crime scene tape. D.S. Edgar flashes his badge and raises the tape above my head. A big man steps from the crowd, yelling,
"Is it her? Is it our Jodie?"
He's wearing a fawn-coloured raincoat tight across his chest, and his head seems to perch like a stone ball on top of his shoulders.
"Please go home, Mr. Sheehan," says Edgar. "We'll tell you as soon as we know something."
He tries to force his way past the police, but is pushed back. A younger man grabs his arm.
"Come on, Dad," he says. "Let it go."
He's a smaller, deflated version of his father, with short hair and long sideburns that reach down his cheeks.
"Poor bastards,"
mutters Edgar, as we walk in single file along an asphalt path, entering a large copse of trees surrounded by a wild meadow. It's 4:30 and already growing dark. Ahead of us, three lampposts cast pools of light that lengthen and shorten our shadows. Further on, we reach the footbridge with welded metal handrails and the sound of running water underneath. As we cross Fareham Brook, I glance over the side and see where the channel widens into a pond fringed by reeds. 80 yards away, in a small clearing, tree trunks have been turned to silver by bright lights, and portable generators are throbbing like a drum track playing on a loop. A white canvas tent has been erected at the base of a steep embankment. Lit from within, it glows like a Chinese paper lantern with moths trapped inside. Two Land Rovers are parked at the western side of the footbridge. Lenny Parvel is seated in one of them, talking on a two-way radio. I wait until she's finished. She shakes my hand, wanting to pull me closer into a hug, but this is work. Her hazel eyes soften.
"I wouldn't normally."
"Yes, you would."
Dressed in a barber jacket and Wellingtons that reach as high as her knees, she has pale, fine features and bottle black hair cut short enough to brush against her shoulders. Lenny isn't her real name. She was christened Lenore Eustace Mary Parvel by parents who thought a long name would give their daughter added status, although Lenny would dispute this. She once told me she'd have earned an extra A-level if she hadn't spent so much time filling out her name. Lenny was the first police officer on the scene when my parents and sisters were murdered. She found me hiding in the garden shed, where I'd armed myself with a mattock, convinced I was the next to die. It was Lenny who coaxed me out and wrapped me in her coat and sat with me until the cavalry arrived. I remember her crouching beside the open door of the patrol car, asking me my name. She offered me a tic-tac, holding my trembling hand as she shook them onto my palm. That moment, her touch made me realize that there was still warmth in the world. In the days that followed, Lenny sat with me during the police interviews and watched over me when I slept in a fold-out bed at the station. During the committal hearings and the trial, she shielded me from the media and chaperoned me to court, keeping me company as I waited to give evidence. She was sitting at the back of the courtroom when I swore to tell the truth and tried not to look at my brother in the dock. Back then, she was a constable, barely a year into the job. Now she's head of the Serious Operations Unit in Nottinghamshire Police, married, divorced, remarried, with two grown-up stepchildren. I'm like a third.
"How much did Edgar tell you?"
she asks. "Jodie Sheehan, aged 15, went missing last night." Lenny shows me a photograph of two girls pointing to Jodie, a slow-eyed teen with thick brown hair and a gap in her front teeth that braces didn't fix.
"She was last seen by her cousin, Tasmin Whittaker, at 8:05 at a fireworks display less than a mile from here."
Lenny points to the second girl in the picture, who is taller and heavier, with a round face and a lopsided smile.
"Jodie told Tasmin she was going to a chippy on Southchurch Drive. They planned to meet up later at Tasmin's house. Jodie didn't arrive."
Lenny leads me down the muddy path that switches back and forth and grows steeper in places. As we near the tent, duck boards are set out like stepping stones, and arc lights create pools of bright light that turn dew-beaded cobwebs into jewelled threads. A canvas flap is pulled back, and I catch a glimpse of the body. Jodie Sheehan is lying on her right side with her knees pulled up towards her chest. Her jeans and knickers are bunched at her ankles above her suede boots, and her sweater has been pulled up beneath her chin. Her bra is unclasped and twisted to the side, exposing small, pale breasts that are stained with mud or blood. Her eyes are open, popping slightly, with a dull white sheen as though cataracts have grown across her pupils. I feel embarrassed by her nakedness. I want to pull up her jeans and pull down her sweater and say how sorry I am that we're meeting like this. I want to apologize that people are taking photographs and scraping beneath her fingernails and swabbing her orifices. I'm sorry that she can't tell me who did this to her, or point him out from a lineup, or scrawl his name on a piece of paper. I crouch and notice the leaves and grass clinging to her hair. There are scratches on her hands and forearms, and bruising to her right eye, and a bump on her forehead. She's wearing a single earring, a delicate silver stud that catches the light. Where is the other one? Was it lost in a struggle, or taken as a souvenir? A ghost-like figure steps into the tent. Clad from head to toe in shapeless hooded coveralls, Robert Ness is barely recognisable, but he makes the tent feel smaller because of his bulk. The senior Home Office pathologist, sometimes called Nessie, is in his late 40s, with skin so dark it makes the whites of his eyes seem brighter. He's wearing rimless glasses that momentarily catch the light when he tilts his head.
"Do you two know each other?"
asks Lenny. We nod, but don't shake hands.
"Let's make this quick," says Ness. "I don't want to leave her out here."
"When did she die?"
asks Lenny.
"Early hours. It was cold last night, which lowered her body temperature and kept the insects away."
"Cause of death?"
"Unclear. She suffered a blow to the back of her head that didn't fracture her skull, but might have rendered her unconscious. I'll know more after the post-mortem."
"Was she sexually assaulted?" I ask.
"There are traces of semen in her hair."
A bubble of air gets trapped in my throat. The pathologist drops to his haunches, pointing to Jodie's boots.
"They're full of water, and I found pondweed in her hair. Fairham Brook is beyond those trees."
He indicates the bruising on her forehead.
"That's an impact injury, likely caused by a fall."
"What about the scratches on her arms?"
"From branches and brambles,"
she tried to run. Lenny turns away and summons DS Edgar.
I want police divers here at first light. We're looking for her mobile phone and a polka dot print tote bag.
Leaving the Soko tent, I keep to the dock boards until I reach the perimeter of the crime scene. A carpet of papery leaves squelches beneath my boots, hiding roots that bump up from the ground, ready to catch my ankles. In daylight, the clearing would be visible from the footpath, or the top of the embankment. At night, it disappears and becomes darker than the meadow because overhanging branches block out the ambient light. Lenny has joined me. We scramble up the embankment using the trees as handholds.
Where does the footpath lead? I ask.
Once it crosses the footbridge, it hits a T-junction. To the right is Farnborough Road. Turn left and it crosses the tram lines and eventually reaches Forsyth Academy, Jodie's school. Her family lives beyond, in Clifton. This would have been a shortcut home.
From where?
Her cousin's house. Tasmin Whittaker lives 5 minutes from here.
Below us, a group of forensic technicians have lifted Jodie's body onto a white plastic sheet that is folded over her and sealed. A second layer of plastic is zipped up, cocooning her in a bag with handles that is carried by 4 men to a waiting ambulance. Lenny watches in silence, her dark hair boxed on her neck.
The tabloids will have wet dreams over this one. A pretty church-going schoolgirl, a champion figure skater.
Figure skater?
The Times profiled her during the summer. They called her the Golden Girl of British Skating.
Crossing the footbridge, we follow the asphalt path to the community centre. Most of the locals have gone home, escaping the cold, but TV crews and reporters have taken their places. Cameras are shouldered, spotlights blaze.
Is it Jodie? Someone yells. How did she die? Was she raped? Any suspects?
The questions seem brutal in the circumstances, but Lenny keeps her head down, hands in her pockets. We pause at the police car.
What do you need?
She asks.
Can I talk to her family?
They haven't been formally notified.
I think they know.
Chapter 5. The semi-detached house has a single bay window on the lower floor and a small square of soggy front garden surrounded on 3 sides by a heavily pruned knee-high hedge. 2 vehicles are parked nose to tail in the driveway, one a black cab and the other a new model Lexus with a darker than legal tint on the windows. A police constable is waiting outside, stamping her feet against the cold. Lenny presses a doorbell. Dougal Sheehan answers and looks past us, as though hoping we might have brought his daughter home.
I'm Detective Chief Inspector Lenore Parvel, says Lenny. I wanted to speak to you and your wife.
Wordlessly, he turns and leads us into an over-furnished sitting room with a lumpy sofa and 2 worn armchairs. A TV is showing football with the sound turned down. Maggie Sheehan is standing in the arched doorway to the kitchen. Everything about her is crumpled and diminished. The forward cant of her shoulders, the dark rings beneath her eyes. A string of polished wooden rosary beads are clenched in her fist.
Mrs. Sheehan,
begins Maggie.
Please call me Maggie,
she replies mechanically, before introducing her brother Brian and his wife Felicity, who are sitting at the kitchen table. The Whittakers are Tasmin's parents, come to offer support. Lenny is standing in the centre of the living room with her legs braced apart and hands clasped like she's on a parade ground. Some people own every space they inhabit, but Lenny seems to conquer the room quietly, taking it inch by inch with the force of her personality. Maggie takes a seat on the sofa. The skin above her collarbone is mottled, and there are cracks in the makeup around her eyes. Dougal is next to her. She reaches for his hand. He takes it, reluctantly, as though unwilling to show any frailty. The Whittakers are side by side in the arched doorway, their faces filled with dreadful knowing. Lenny begins.
It is my sad duty to inform you that the body of a teenage girl has been found beside Silverdale Walk. She matches the description of your daughter, Jodie.
Maggie blinks and glances at Dougal, as though waiting for a translation. His eyes are closed, but a tear squeezes from one corner, and he wipes it away with the back of his hand.
How did she die?
He whispers.
We believe her death to be suspicious.
Dougal gets to his feet and sways unsteadily, gripping the back of the sofa for support. He's a big man who looks like a builder or a butcher. Big arms, big hands.
We will need one of you to formally identify Jodie, says Lenny. It doesn't have to be today. I can send a car in the morning.
Where is she now?
Asks Maggie.
She's been taken to the Queen's Medical Centre. There will need to be a post-mortem.
You're going to cut her up, says Dougal.
We're investigating a homicide.
Maggie Sheehan's fingers have found her rosary beads. She clutches the tiny crucifix in her fist, squeezing it so tightly it leaves an imprint when she opens her palm. She must have prayed all day, daring to hope, but nobody has answered. Brian and Felicity hug each other in the doorway. They're physically the same size, but she seems to be holding him up.
We need to establish Jodie's movements, says Lenny. When did you last see her?
At the fireworks, replies Maggie.
We go to Bonfire Night every year, echoes Felicity. Nobody calls it Guy Fawkes Night anymore. Maybe it's not politically correct, the gunpowder plot and all that.
She's a tall, striking woman, with a plume of silver flowing through her thick dark hair from the left side of her temple to the collar of her blouse.
Who was Jodie with at the fireworks? Interrupts Lenny. Tasmin, our daughter. Anyone else? Schoolmates, friends, neighbours. It was like a big street party. I took a bottle of champagne and glasses.
Maggie retrieves a cotton handkerchief from the sleeve of her cardigan and blows her nose. It makes everybody turn.
I should have made her come home after the fireworks,
she whispers, her voice breaking.
I shouldn't have let her stay out.
This is not your fault,
scolds Felicity.
She should have been home. She would have been safe.
Dougal doesn't react, but I can already sense the tension between husband and wife. The recriminations are just beginning. Guilt has to fall somewhere when logic fails. What time did you last see Jodie? I ask.
She found me at 8 o'clock, says Maggie. She asked if she could sleep over at Tasmin's house. I told her she had to be up early for training.
Training?
The Nationals are coming up, explains Brian Whittaker. We're on the ice by 6:30, six mornings a week.
You're Jodie's coach, I say.
I taught her to skate.
Almost before she could walk,
echoes Maggie. Brother and sister have similar eyes and the same shaped noses. Maggie is rounder and softer, while Brian has slim hips and slender hands. He looks like a dancer in the way he stands, with a straight back, square shoulders and raised chin. Attention shifts to the TV, where the football has been replaced by a news bulletin. Drone footage shows the pale outline of a forensic tent, almost hidden from view by overhanging branches. The next pictures are of police searching the uncut meadow, walking in a long straight line through knee-high grass. One of them pauses, crouches, and picks up a discarded soft drink can, which he places in a plastic evidence bag. The picture changes again. This time, Jodie's body is being carried up the embankment.
Turn it off, begs Maggie.
Dougal reaches for the TV remote, fumbles, curses. The screen goes black.
Why would anyone hurt our baby?
Whispers Maggie. Her shoulders heave, as though shifting weight from one to the other. Lenny glances at me, but I have no words to make this right. I know what awaits them. In the days to come, Jodie's life will be picked apart by the media, who will feast on this story. The young, golden girl of skating, who dreamed of Olympic glory but died in a cold, muddy clearing less than a mile from her home. As a forensic psychologist, I have met killers and psychopaths and sociopaths, but I refuse to define people as being good or evil. Wrongdoing is an absence of something good rather than something fated or written in our DNA or forced upon us by shitty parents or careless teachers.
or cruel friendships. Evil is not a state, it is a property, and when a person is in possession of enough property, it sometimes begins to define them. Would it benefit the Sheehans if I told them this? No. It won't bring them comfort when they lie beside each other tonight, staring at the ceiling, wondering what they might have done differently. People who lose children have their hearts warped into weird shapes. Losing a child is beyond comprehension. It defies biology. It contradicts the natural order of history and genealogy. It derails common sense. It violates time. It creates a huge black bottomless hole that swallows hope. Dougal is pouring himself a drink at a bar cabinet. Most of the bottles have duty-free stickers still attached. Maggie seems more relaxed when he's not focused on her. She talks more freely. Remembers.
When Jodie learned to ride a bike, I wouldn't let her leave the cul-de-sac because I didn't want her riding out of sight. People said I was overprotective, but I know how these things happen. Later, when she started school, I let her walk to Tasman's house, but never in the dark, not on that footpath. We used to call it the Black Path because it had no lights. Even when the council finally put them in, we still called it the Black Path.
Why did Jodie and Tasman split up last night? I ask.
Jodie went to get fish and chips,
says Felicity. By herself? Nobody answers. Does she have a boyfriend? I ask.
Not a proper one, says Felicity. Sometimes she hangs out with Toby Leith.
The rich kid,
Dougal says, in a mocking tone. He's not that rich, says Brian. His father has a car dealership. How old is Toby? I ask.
Too old, says Dougal.
He's 18,
explains Felicity, who doesn't like correcting her brother-in-law.
They only hang out.
Dougal reacts angrily.
What does that even mean? Jodie was supposed to be in training, not running around with some horny chav with a flash motor.
Maggie flinches and looks even more miserable.
When did you realise that Jodie was missing? I ask, wanting to change the subject.
She was supposed to come back to ours, explains Felicity. Tasman waited up until 11 and then fell asleep.
Did Jodie have a key?
Tasman left the patio door unlocked.
She was out there all night, says Dougal,
his voice breaking. Felicity sits on the edge of his armchair and brushes his cheek with her hand. It's an intimate gesture, like watching Androcles pulling a thorn from the lion's paw. These people are close, I think. They have raised their children together, celebrating birthdays, christenings, anniversaries and milestones, the highs and the lows.
I went to wake Jodie for training, but she wasn't in Tasman's room, says Brian. I figured she must have gone home last night, so I drove by here to pick her up. That's when we realised that she'd been missing all night.
And you phoned the police,
says Lenny. The couples look at each other, waiting for someone else to answer.
Well, we looked for her first, says Brian defensively. I went to the ice rink. Tasman began phoning her friends.
Lenny studies Dougal.
What about you?
He motions to the window and the black cab outside.
I was working last night. I got home around 7 and went straight out again looking for Jodie.
Where?
I walked along the footpath.
What made you immediately think of Silverdale Walk?
It's the way home,
he replies, as though it should be obvious. His voice catches.
I must have walked right past her.
Maggie is staring at the wall as though looking into the past.
What did you do? I ask.
I prayed. Someone had to stay here in case Jodie called or came home, explains Felicity.
Lenny seems to be quietly plotting the timeline of events. It made no difference when the police were called. Jodie had been dead for hours.
Is there anyone who might have wanted to harm your daughter?
Asks Lenny. Maggie answers.
What do you mean?
Did she talk about anyone following her? Someone who might have looked out of place or made her feel uncomfortable or unsafe?
Nobody responds.
Is there anyone who might want to hurt your family?
Dougal makes a scoffing sound.
I drive a cab. Maggie works in the school canteen. We're not low-life crims or scumbags.
Lenny doesn't react. Perhaps she should be talking to the parents separately to gauge their different responses. Dougal has the stronger personality, and Maggie defers to him, never questioning his answers or interrupting. She's not subservient, but neither is she an equal in the relationship. I walk to the sliding doors and peer into the darkness of the garden. An outside light reveals a deck with a hot tub, covered for the winter. I try to picture Jodie here, but have too little information to breathe life into her pale corpse. I need to discover who she was before if I'm to understand what happened to her. Was she friendly and approachable? Would she say hello to a stranger who passed her on the footpath late at night? Would she nod and smile, or drop her head, avoiding eye contact? Would she run if attacked? Would she fight back? Would she submit? Can I see Jodie's room? I ask, directing the question at Dougal. He hesitates for a moment before showing me up the stairs. Jodie's room is nearest the shared bathroom. Dougal won't come inside. He hovers in the doorway, as though waiting for permission to enter from a daughter who will never be able to grant it. The pillow on Jodie's bed has a small indentation where her head last rested. Next to it is a floppy ragdoll with yellow yarn curls and button eyes. It is a typical teenager's room. Messy, cluttered, characterful. Dirty clothes are strewn near a wicker basket, and a lone shoe has been thrown towards the wardrobe. I have to stop myself wanting to bend down and put it in place. A damp towel from yesterday is lying on the floor. Studying the room, I imagine Jodie sitting cross-legged on the bed, a little girl playing with dolls and cutting and pasting pictures. She grew up and graduated from crayons to eyeliner, from Barbies to boy bands. Every detail resonates. The book on her bedside table, doodles on a piece of paper, a collection of lanyards hanging from the doorknob. Her shelves are lined with ice skating trophies and medals. The wall above her bed is covered in photographs and posters of skaters, some of whom I recognise. Katarina Witt is among them, as well as Tessa Virtue and Scott Moyer. The camera has captured many in midair, seemingly defying gravity, while others glide across the ice with the grace of ballet dancers. Polaroids are pinned to a corkboard above Jodie's desk. Most of them show Jodie and Tasmin together. They are sitting on each other's laps in a photo booth, pulling faces at the camera. Jodie is the prettier of the two. Tasmin is more self-conscious about her looks, tilting her face to hide the weight she carries around her neck. Jodie is smaller, with a skater's body, slim and muscled. She's more at ease with her body, showing it off in miniskirts and tight tops. I notice a barrel bolt lock on the door, which has been affixed in a wonky fashion.
That was Jodie's doing, explains Dougal. She wanted her privacy.
Who was she trying to keep out?
Her brother, mainly. Felix can push her buttons.
He's older.
21.
I remember the youth I saw at the community centre, urging Dougal to go home. Does Felix live here? I ask.
He comes and goes.
There are more trophies on a shelf above Jodie's bed. Some have come from junior competitions in Moscow, Berlin and Hungary. You must have been very proud, I say.
Every time I watched her skate.
Dougal inhales, holds his breath, and exhales.
Most people take figure skating for granted. They don't realise what goes into it, the courage and skill it takes to glide across the ice and spring into the air and spin three or four times before landing on a single blade as sharp as a knife. I'm a boneheaded man. I don't read books or recite poetry or understand paintings, but Jodie was beautiful on the ice. Truly breathtaking.
Lenny calls up the stairs. She's ready to go.
We offer our condolences and leave two devastated families to their grief. Outside, as I reach the police car, I pause and turn back towards the house. A figure is standing motionless in an upstairs window, gazing steadily in our direction. Felix Sheehan is shirtless, or perhaps naked, his lower half shielded. He flicks at a cigarette lighter, triggering a flame and dousing it, while looking directly at us with a hatred that sustains rather than corrodes him. What does he want to burn, I wonder? And why does he want to burn it?
Chapter 6. Angel Face.
Do you remember your mother?
Asks Guthrie. With her long blonde hair and eyes of blue, the only thing I ever got from her was sorrow, sorrow.
You're quoting David Bowie.
I like David Bowie. Guthrie is wearing a funky patterned jumper that was probably knitted by his mother. It's too heavy for the